Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll replay an interview with Christine Heinrichs, a docent at Piedras Blancas State Park on California's Central Coast. She'll tell us about the mysteries of elephant seals. To set the stage, I'll first play today's creature call. Listen carefully and try to identify the type of animal that makes this sound. The first set of sounds will be females, and the second set will be males. And now for the males. Now, let me turn to my conversation on elephant seals with Christine Heinrichs. Ms. Heinrichs enjoys animals of all kinds, wild and domestic, and has written two books on domestic poultry, How to Raise Chickens and How to Raise Poultry, which focus on raising traditional breeds in small flocks. She is a docent with Friends of the Elephant Seal at Piedras Blancas, an elephant seal rookery on California's Central Coast. There, she helps protect these large marine mammals and educate visitors about their unique characteristics. As I learned from our conversation, northern elephant seals are extraordinary creatures. Most people probably know the species because of the males, whose long floppy noses give elephant seals their name. But did you know that they spend 8 to 10 months a year in the open ocean? And to find food, they dive incredibly deep, to depths between 1,000 and 5,000 feet, and they stay underwater up to 2 hours. Twice a year, they migrate thousands of miles to their land-based rookeries to give birth, breed, molt, and rest. Ms. Heinrichs works at one of these places, the Piedras Blancas Rookery, which is home to over 15,000 elephant seals. When I spoke to her in November 2009, I asked how she became interested in these fascinating creatures.
Living out here on California's Central Coast in a small town called Los Osos, back in the 1990s, which is actually when the elephant seals first began to colonize the beach here. They were previously unknown on these beaches, and in 1990, the first elephant seal was observed on the beach, and in 1992, the first birth was recorded on the beach there. And so that was just a few seals. The colony has since grown to an estimated 16,000 seals that use this beach at various times of the year. They're never all here at one time.
What was it like when the animals first arrived there?
These animals are really large. The females are between 1,000 and 1,500 pounds, and the males can be up to 5,000 pounds. So this is a very dramatic event on the coast, and this beach is right next to Highway 1. So people would just stop their cars and jump out of them and run down onto the beach to see these huge animals, obviously getting out of hand in a hurry. And it was one of those changes in wildlife habitat that sometimes surprises humans. So it took a little while for the government entities involved to get up to speed on it and really protect these animals and protect the people. You know, these are top predators. They have huge teeth. They, when they're on the beach, they don't seem to take much notice of humans. They're not like California sea lions or harbor seals, which are kind of shy. They just ignore people until you get in their way. And there were some episodes in which people were severely injured. And so the state had to step in and do something, and eventually what they did was they arranged an exchange of some land with the Hearst Ranch, which is right on the other side of Highway 1, and rerouted the highway and have built a boardwalk and a parking lot and a viewing area right there over the beach that the elephant seals have adopted for their own.
So how did you get involved in protecting these seals?
I lived back there at that time and was watching this whole series of events unfold, and a nonprofit organization got organized to advocate for appreciating these animals and noticing that they were there and taking some kind of care of them. And that's the Friends of the Elephant Seal, and they have a website at elephantseal.org.
Tell me a little bit about that organization.
So they have actually worked with both the state and the county to develop docent programs and to actually staff this small state park. As I'm sure everyone knows by now, California has no money and is in fact shutting down state parks. Yeah, we don't need to go into the financial problems of California. But one of the effects is that there's no staff for this. There's one ranger for 50 miles of coastline out here. So there's effectively no monitoring going on. And so it's staffed by volunteers. I think there's about 90 active docents now, and there's a volunteer. There's at least one, usually more than one docent out there every day between the hours of 10 and 4.
Is that the only time the site is open?
The site, of course, is open around the clock. There's really no security there. And you know, people are surprised, and I think this is one of the strengths of this site, is that really, you know, if you wanted to go down to the beach, there's really no reason why, there's nothing physical standing in the way.
Exactly where is the park, and what's the name of the
The park is Piedras Blancas. It is just south of the Piedras Blancas Lighthouse. It's about 8 miles north of Hearst Castle on California's Scenic Highway 1, which is the highway that goes through Big Sur and up and down the coast. So it's by law to be maintained as a two-lane highway, and that's what it is, and it's quite rural. For people who haven't been to California or who have only seen Los Angeles and San Diego and San Francisco, you know, it looks like the city is just one, the state is just one huge megalopolis. But in fact, most of the state is agricultural. And so Highway 1 goes through miles and miles of really almost nothing. And it's very beautiful, and it's right along the coast. That, of course, is one of the weak spots because it often is closed down due to, last summer it was closed down because of fires in Big Sur. And then in the winter, our traditional, we get them some rain, and then it's closed by mudslides. So, but it's a wonderful drive if you have the time to do it. And most people are unaware that the elephant seals are there. Almost all the people who stop just happen to see a sign. So the signage is provided by Caltrans, and they have one small sign that says Elephant Seal Viewing Area. And so people just kind of happen onto it and are always delighted. I mean, how many places can you go where you see 1,000 or more huge wild animals just arrayed before you living their lives? It's truly a unique spot.
And what caused them to come to that place in the first place? Because you said previously they were unknown, and then in 1990 the first one was seen. And so was there some change in currents, or what sort of caused them to come, or don't you know?
Well, they don't really know for sure, but the feeling is there's a colony north of here at a spot called Año Nuevo, and there's a lot of research going on there. UC Santa Cruz has a research station there, and there's a project called Tagging of Pelagic Predators that does a lot of work there, TOPP.org. And they have even posted critter cams on a couple of these animals.
How does one go about studying these animals?
Because of course, they're very difficult to research. They are basically a deep water animal. They do most of their hunting at depths of 1,000 feet and deeper. And so they're very difficult to research. The females spend about 10 months of the year out in the ocean. The males spend about 8 months of the year out in the ocean. So they really are only on land part of their lives. But there's always some animals on the beach because they vary in their life, in their annual cycle. And so I can talk about that more. Anyway, the feeling is that the colony at Año Nuevo was getting too large, and that this is, they began extending south and found this area, which actually is one of the few beaches along the California coast that is suitable for them, because one of the big problems they have is that although they're deep water animals, their pups cannot swim when they're born. So they have to have a beach that will remain high and dry for at least that part of that time, at least long enough for the pups to learn how to swim.
When do the pups learn to swim? Is that unusual for seals that pups can't swim right away, or is that common?
Most seals can swim at least a little, and these really can't. And if there's a high tide combined with a storm and the beach is inundated, they will drown. So, yeah, it's very tragic when it happens. And the pups are born in January and February, when there often are high tides and storms. So, but this beach is large enough in places that there's always some dry land for them.
And when do they learn to swim? And how do they learn to swim?
Yeah, they teach each other, oddly enough. And this is something that people can come and see. The pups are born in January and February, and the mothers nurse them for about a month. And then weaning is very abrupt. The mother just one day returns to the ocean. And the pups are left on the beach. And, of course, at that time, there's a large group of mothers and pups there. Some of the pups figure out how to steal milk from other mothers. But most of them they call them super weaners, and some of them get absolutely huge. But most of them just begin to manage on their own from there. And over time, all the mothers return to the ocean, and the pups are left there on the beach, and they begin exercising and playing in the water and teaching themselves how to swim.
How long does that go on for?
When they're about 4 months old, they are good enough swimmers that they then embark on their first migration solo.
And where do they migrate to?
They migrate both north up as far as the Aleutian Islands. Most, as far as I can tell, it's hard to tell what happens in that first year, but they don't believe that, most pups make it all the way to the Aleutians on their first migration. But they do go far north along the coast of Canada and generally out into the northern Pacific. Generally speaking, the males migrate more north to the Aleutians and the females more out into the Pacific.
Why is that? Why do males and females differ? And do they travel in groups or do they travel alone?
They are solitary hunters when they are out there. Yeah, they're social on the beach, and they're there in large numbers, but when they are hunting, they depart from the beach, and they return alone, and they appear to hunt alone. So these are animals with a lot of poorly understood behaviors, but it seems as if the hunting habits of the females are a little bit different from the hunting of the males, and that the males are more searching the bottom, and the females are more opportunistic about feeding on the way down on their dives. But that's far from definitive. This is really based, you can appreciate how difficult it is to study these animals.
What do they eat? Do people know
they eat squid and fish. And that was something that was very interesting to me when I first started looking at them, was these are deep water feeders, but they have very large eyes, which suggested to me, how can they be sight hunters if they're feeding at depths of 1,000 feet and deeper? There's no light down there. but actually there is. A lot of their prey, such as the Humboldt squid, actually has flashes of bioluminescence. So there's actually more light down there than one would immediately think.
So when you say sight hunters, they hunt mostly from seeing their prey versus sensing them in other ways. Is that right?
Well, they do have vibrissae, whiskers that can detect movement, and they can hunt like that. There's some feeling that they may also use echolocation, because they have put recorders on these animals, and they've recorded some unusual sounds. So there's some feeling that they are using echolocation to locate prey. But again, that's not definitively known yet.
Interesting. And can you describe a little bit what they look like and what they sound like and what they smell like?
Well, they don't smell as bad as you would think when you think of having thousands of these animals on the beach. They're fasting when they're on the beach. They do not eat in this area. This is it's not deep enough here, and they don't eat when they're in the Central Coast area. They eat out in the open ocean. So this is another thing that I've asked this question because I've noticed that some of them, when they're arriving, defecate just before they get onto the beach. And so, you know, if we had 16,000 animals defecating on this beach, it would be unbearable. But they don't. They don't. And it doesn't appear that the pups defecate at all either. This is one of those mysteries of metabolism, that they are able to rely entirely on their blubber to meet all their nutritional needs. So that's a good thing. You know, there is some smell. Some people object to it, but, you know, you figure you got a lot of wild animals sitting in one place, and there's bound to be a little, just sort of smells a little sour. I don't find it terrible.
What do they look like? Because we always picture a big seal with a long nose. Do they all have that, or is it just the males?
It's just the adult males. They start developing that when they're about 5 years old, and it grows throughout their lives, but it is pretty much developed into what you are thinking of as like an elephant's trunk by the time they're about 8 years old. But the females never develop that.
Do researchers know what the purpose of that long nose is?
It appears to be a secondary sexual characteristic that the males develop that is visually imposing to their foes. It also does inflate somewhat.
What do the females look like?
They look not dissimilar from harbor seals. Except, of course, they're larger, and the harbor seals have a spotted coat rather than the plain single color.
What color are they?
Well, they range from sort of a yellowish brown through almost black. The males tend to be darker than the females, but there's a lot of overlap between the colors. They have a lighter underside and a darker back, which is very typical of marine mammals, because it's a kind of camouflage to their predators. Predators underneath them will look up and see the lighter ventral side blending in with any light coming from the surface, and looking down from the top, they'll see the dark back blending in with the dark of the ocean depths.
And who are their predators?
Well, great white sharks are a main predator. Other sharks do prey on them, but perhaps not to entirely kill them. We often see a very typical scar on elephant seals. It's almost a perfect circle, and it's made by what's called the cookie cutter shark, because it does leave that kind of wound. It's a shark that has teeth only in its lower jaw, and it attaches to the animal and then spins around, so it cuts out a circular piece of flesh. And the animals typically, you know, they often survive this because we often see them with these scars. Orca whales are also predators of these critters. Not right in this area. We're sort of at the southern edge of the range of the West Coast orcas. But, of course, since these animals travel north and west, they do they are subject to predation by orcas.
What do the animals sound like?
They have an unusual vocalization. It's really beyond description. Some people have described it as being like a Harley warming up inside a gymnasium. But I don't think that that really conveys this very unusual. We don't really have a word to describe it. The females have a bark. That's easy to describe. But the males have this very unusual sort of belching vocalization that resonates across the water and is very impressive. And their noses do inflate and may help to resonate that. The males also develop a large chest of thick calloused skin, and that's where they attack each other. They rear back, pull their front quarters up and their heads, and then they beat their heads against each other's chests, and this is how they fight. And they do rip and tear with their teeth, and those calloused areas do bleed, but the fighting is not to the death. They fight to establish their dominance over each other. Most fights are relatively short, 2 to 4 minutes, but occasionally a fight will go on for half an hour.
Are they fighting over a particular female or over territory or a group of females?
Well, it's not exactly territorial, but it does involve their breeding, because it's only the dominant male, who's called the beachmaster, who gets to breed. So there's really a lot at stake for them. And there'll be a number of beachmasters strung out along the beach during breeding season, each one defending as many females as he possibly can. That's usually about 30 to 40 females. And, of course, that beachmaster is subject to constant challenge by subdominant males. And the only way he can maintain his breeding rights is to be able to dominate those other males throughout the season. And it's tough for those guys, too, because they arrive on the beach in November and start fighting with each other and dividing up the beach area. But the females don't arrive until December. And they finally start showing up after Christmas and having their pups. They then nurse their pups for 28 to 30 days. And finally, at the end of lactation, they come into estrus and they're receptive to the males for breeding. So at that point, those males have been on the beach for 2 to 3 months and they without eating. So they finally get a chance to breed, but they have lost a lot of their body weight, and there's certainly the potential that a male who was able to dominate a harem early in the season can always be deposed.
Do the males protect the pups at all, or are they involved with the females in any way while they're giving birth and nursing?
Very, very little. Their interest is real single focus. And it's not unknown for a male to just lumber right over females and pups. When he's challenged, if there's females and pups between him and a challenger, he'll just head for it. And pups are occasionally killed. Usually the sand's pretty forgiving, and unless the male just stays on top of the pup and suffocates it, they usually survive. But They have really very little interest. On occasion, and I have seen this, when the females are ready to go back into the ocean after the end of lactation, they are very weakened. They've been on the beach for a month or so, and they have given birth and have nursed the pup from birth weight, which is 60 to 80 pounds, up to about 350 pounds.
Wow.
Without any food. So they are really just skin and bones at that point, and they desperately need to return to the ocean and start eating again. But they have to really run a gauntlet of all these subdominant males who are extremely eager to breed and will do anything to hold that female down and breed her. And so I have actually seen on occasion a dominant male will escort a female into the water so that she can escape and survive.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, it's surprising because there is really very little courtliness involved with these critters otherwise.
Who knew an elephant seal could be chivalrous?
But they have done that. I've actually witnessed that. And it's touching because otherwise the female can actually be killed just trying to return to the ocean.
Wow. Are they around year-round, or does everybody come at one time? You said typically the pups are born in January or February. Are there times when
Right.
the beach is empty, I guess?
Right. Well, it's a constantly changing population. Like right now, at this time of year, this is November, there are a lot of juvenile seals on the beach, youngsters less than 6 years old. Some adult females are out there who are pregnant, but most of them are juvenile males and juvenile females. Now, they're out there for 4 to 6 weeks taking a rest, and then they'll gradually, one by one, start returning to the ocean as subdominant males, perhaps 7 or 8 years old, perhaps not quite old enough to actually defend a territory. They'll start arriving. Actually, there were a few on the beach this week. And then at the end of the month, the fully adult males will start arriving after Thanksgiving. So, you know, and then it goes into females arrive and have their pups. So there's an annual cycle involved, and there's always animals on the beach. Sometimes there's more than others, sometimes there's thousands, sometimes there's only a few. But for people who are coming to see these animals, there's always some animals to see. And it just depends on what time of year and where they are in their annual cycle.
And what I've heard about their molting I'm curious about some of their other physical adaptations.
Now, their molt takes place in the summer. Remember, these are animals who are swimming nonstop for months on end. So that raises questions about what sleep means for them and so forth. But, you know, people see them on the beach sleeping and say, oh, well, you know, what an easy life. Well, you know, it is when they're on land, but not the rest of the time. So they start returning in April and May for their molt, and the females come separately from the males. So they're on the beach, and it's called a catastrophic molt because the skin just peels off in chunks, and there's new skin underneath. It doesn't appear to be painful at all. They don't even seem to itch at it to remove it. It just kind of peels off at its own rate. And the Friends of the Elephant Seal actually have collected some of this skin through the biologist that we work with here. And so we have that as one of the things that we can show people, and they can touch it.
And what does it look like, or what is it sort of like snake skin? Because when you think of a molt, a catastrophic molt like that, you think of snakes shedding their skin.
Yeah, it is like that in the sense that it's large sheets of skin, but it's not in that it is actually, it's furry. It's furry on both sides. The way the molt happens is that the follicles begin to dissolve as the new skin is formed underneath. And so when those follicles dissolve and the new skin is ready, is completely formed, then the old skin just peels off. These animals don't have real beautiful fur. It's kind of bristly. It's not real beautiful. It's just kind of a dull brown. Because they are deep water animals, they can't really rely on their fur to keep them warm, because at those depths, the pressure is so great that any trapped air would be squeezed out. Animals that rely on their fur, such as otters and fur seals, they keep their beautiful fur well oiled and cared for so that it can trap air, and that's actually what insulates them and keeps them warm in the water. These animals rely on their blubber to stay warm.
And how much blubber do they have? How many inches, you know, in their skin?
Well, of course, it varies a lot because they do fast during times of the year, but a lot. I don't know in inches, but certainly 8 or 10 inches would be not an unreasonable amount. They actually were hunted for their blubber, and they were almost hunted to extinction.
What is their conservation status and how they're protected?
Well, they're protected by the Marine Mammal Protection Act, so they cannot be harassed or approached in any way, which, of course, is a challenge here on the Central Coast, where they also, the rookery actually extends down on a part of the beach that's also well known as a windsurfing beach, and people come from all over the world to windsurf there. So the theory of state parks is that that beach is open for water-related activities, but not open for elephant seal viewing. So with one ranger every 50 miles, you can imagine that can't be very well enforced. But one of the values of the viewing site is that it's a place for public education, to try to educate the public that these, we can share our beaches with these large mammals without doing anything foolish like approaching them.
Are they threatened or endangered? Because they
No, they are not right now.
To extinction.
Yeah, they were hunted down to what's believed to be certainly less than 100 individuals, possibly fewer than 30. But that remnant population stayed alive on one of the offshore islands off Mexico and has since recovered to an estimated population of between 150,000 and 200,000 animals now. So that's very good. One of the fears is that because of that genetic bottleneck that happened around the turn of the 20th century, these animals may be genetically very similar and could be subject to devastating effects on their population if they were subject to some illness. It's one of the reasons that we try to make sure that people keep dogs off the beach, because there's a feeling that they might be subject to parvo.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, so that's one of the concerns, but they are not currently considered endangered. This is sort of a success story of a species that on its own has made a recovery.
You're listening to The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nimi. And today's guest is Christine Heinrichs, an author and docent at Piedras Blancas Elephant Seal Rookery on California's Central Coast. Now, back to our conversation about the unusual secrets of elephant seals. Have elephant seals been affected by climate change?
Well, right now, they seem to be actually benefiting from an effect of global warming, which is that their main prey species, which is the Humboldt squid, which is a predatory, a large predatory squid, it's not like the calamari that people eat. These are 4 to 6 feet long animals. They're quite impressive. and they are aggressive hunters, but they seem to be experiencing something of a population boom. And so the elephant seals have plenty to eat right now. You know, how that kind of imbalance eventually will work out is not known. But right now, the animals we see on the beach look very healthy. They're large and fat. We do occasionally see animals that are snared in plastics. And we work with another group, the Marine Mammal Rescue people, to try to save them if it's possible. Otherwise, at the rookery, no one interferes with them. It's considered a wildlife habitat, and, you know, if an animal pulls up on shore and it's been severely injured by a shark attack, we do not intervene. Or, you know, pups die. You know, sometimes they are killed by the males, or they get separated from their mothers and they starve. And this is not painful. This is not pleasant to watch. It is very painful. And I just tell people, this isn't Disney World. You know, this is what happens, and not every animal can survive. And we just have to kind of look beyond that to the health of the whole species. But when we do find an animal that's in trouble because of something human-caused, like a piece of plastic around its neck, we do call the Marine Mammal Rescue people. They have a permit, and they can get permission to go down on the beach and try and rescue. What they do is they have what looks like pieces of fence with handles on the back of it, and they call them herding boards, and they use that to try to separate the animal from the rest of the herd and into some corner where they can isolate it and get someone in there to cut the plastic off it. And if possible, they'll then give it a shot of an antibiotic, and that's the treatment. And this can occasionally be successfully done. You know, they have certainly freed a number of animals from plastic, and there was one animal who had plastic very severely constricting his neck, and it remained as a scar, and it almost looked like the plastic was still there. And he returned for several years to continue to breed on the beach. So these rescues can be successful.
And what kind of plastic is it? Is it plastic bags that people dump, or what kind of refuse do they get tangled up in?
It's more fishing nets. It's because these are large animals, and so they get tangled up in it and get their heads through it, and then it'll be around them, and then they continue to grow, and eventually the plastic is too constricting.
And I wanted to have you take me through a day in the life of an elephant seal, and because I've heard that their metabolism is really interesting, that they have different metabolism at the surface and underwater because they spend so much time underwater. So, or don't
right,
really they, know what their day is like.
Well, you know, a day varies, you know, whether they're on land or in the water, but they do. They have amazing adaptations that allow them to dive as deep as a mile underwater. I mean, this would kill most other animals, and yet these animals do this routinely. It's, you know, not all dive as deep as a mile, but that has been reported. And actually, in the case of that particular individual, the depth recorder actually stopped functioning at that depth, and the animal was still headed down.
Oh,
so.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the difficulty of researching this animal can't really be overstated.
What allows it to be able to dive that deep?
Well, they carry a lot of hemoglobin, which is the oxygen-carrying molecule. They have about twice the blood volume of a comparable-sized land mammal. So they have a lot of hemoglobin. They also have a lot of myoglobin in their muscles, which is a similar oxygen-carrying molecule, and that allows them to continue functioning at great depths. They come to the surface only briefly to exchange air in their lungs and then breathe the air out again so that they are not diving with gas in their lungs. They're at the surface for only 2 to 4 minutes for that exchange, and then they dive down again. They're able to reduce their metabolism to as few as one heartbeat per minute, so that they are not consuming a lot of oxygen on the way down. They are expert swimmers. They use mostly the forward part of their body, and the tail also helps them to propel themselves downward, and it's more of a free fall so that they are not expending a huge amount of energy going down. And then they hunt while they're at depth. And of course they do, you know, their opportunistic hunting on the way down as well. The males especially do like to get to the bottom, and they will stay down for 20 minutes to an hour and then return to the surface to repeat that gas exchange and dive again. And they are doing that nonstop for those months they're at sea. So that does raise the issue of what sleep means for them.
Yeah, do they sleep?
Well, it's not known. You know, some marine mammals, one hemisphere of the brain sleeps while the other remains alert. So it's possible that that's going on. They've also, some that they've put recording devices on seem to go to a depth of about 1,600 or 1,700 feet and stay there for an hour or so in a sort of quiescent state. And it's thought that that may be a kind of sleep state because that's below the level of most of their predators. So they're relatively safe at that level. But you know, it remains to be seen. And, you know, we watch them sleep on the beach, and they look very peaceful. I mean, people sometimes think that what they're looking at as they look down the beach is just a bunch of old driftwood logs lying on the beach because they can be so quiet. But when you're out there for a while and you watch them, if something happens, they can be instantly alert. You know, they don't have to kind of wake up the way we do, sort of, you know, stirring and kind of coming back to consciousness. So that makes me wonder whether there's still something going on like the independent sleep of both hemispheres.
And how do scientists study them? I mean, are they tagging elephant seals to get information that way, or are they investigating them on the beaches?
Well, they're doing both. Yeah, TOPP.org has a lot of great information about that. They do tag elephant seals, and they have a color-coded tagging system depending on where the animal was born. We have a biologist here with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and he goes down and tries to tag about 10% of the pups each year. And we're Piedras Blancas, which means white rocks in Spanish, so our tags for seals born on this beach are white. But there are a variety of other colors depending on where they were born. Because one of the questions is, do these animals return to the same beach where they were born? What are they doing here? Where are they going? And so they, you know, ask anyone who can actually read a number off the tag to please turn it in. The tags themselves are only about an inch and a half long, and they're placed on their back flippers. So they're not easy to see, and they're not easy to read, but some of the docents bring cameras out and photograph the tags and then take the pictures back to their computers and enhance them and try to read the numbers that way to help keep track of what animals are here. Orange tags mean an animal that's been taken in for rehabilitation, and so it's always interesting to find out, you know, what has happened with animals that have been rehabbed. you know, does it really do any good? And it does seem that, you know, those animals can survive. For marine mammal rescue, if they can't return an elephant seal to full capacity, they euthanize them because there's no halfway for these animals. Their lives are so demanding that if they cannot keep up that deep diving and constant swimming, you know, you're just releasing them to be prey. UC Santa Cruz has a very active research program. They do occasionally attach GPS tracking devices to help determine. That's how they would determine what those migrations are. And occasionally even critter cams.
I wanted to make sure to ask you about how you became a docent and if you had to go through some sort of training and what you typically do as a docent at the park.
Well, the Friends of the Elephant Seal has their own training program, and it's really a great program. It's great to learn anything about the natural history of the area, really, because, of course, we're out there and we see lots of birds and we see otters and dolphins and California sea lions and harbor seals and occasional whales. It's a very good spot for whale watching here. The scientists actually do the California gray whale cow-calf census from the Piedras Blancas Lighthouse, which is within a mile of the beach, because it's just a perfect spot to observe the whales. So all that is included in the training, as well as the information about elephant seals and their lives and physiology and all the things we've been talking about. It's a 3-day program that is conducted once a year, fall, and I go every year. This was my third year doing it because I always learn something. There's always new information that's coming out about these animals, or information that may have been there before that I didn't absorb for some reason. And so it's always good for me to learn it. One of the points that was interesting to me this year is that, you know, since these are deep water animals, what are they doing on the beach at all? And how come their pups can't swim? And one of the points that's been made through some of the research, they did some bone density studies on animals at the beginning of it's called their haul out when they're resting on the beach, and at the end. And one of the things they found was that their bone density increased. And when we look at other deep water mammals, such as whales, you know, when they are beached, their organs just collapse. Their bodies can't be on land successfully. And so since these animals need to be on land because their pups can't swim, they need to come out of the water periodically to build up their bone density so that they're strong enough to do that. So that was a real interesting point to me.
What are some of the strangest things you've seen an elephant seal do?
Well, you know, they're not very playful on the beach, but I have seen a young elephant seal kind of pick up a piece of the kelp seaweed that's on the beach and kind of toss it around playfully. And that really kind of lightened my heart. And elephant seal mothers often adopt other pups. And this is, you know, this is kind of a gray area because the beach is very, very busy. It's pretty much shoulder-to-shoulder elephant seals during the breeding season. There's about 4,000 births on the beach with accompanying mothers and then all the males. So it's very hectic. And if the pup gets separated from the mother, it can starve and die. But, and of course, the mothers, since they're not eating during that period, can really only physiologically afford to nurse one pup. The pup gains about 300 pounds during lactation, and for every pound the pup gains, the mother loses 2 pounds. So it's, you know, it's definitely a kind of knife edge. But The mothers are often very understanding of pups that are lost. And I have watched, you know, if you're out there for a few hours, this is another gift of being an elephant seal docent, is that you stand there for hours and you can watch social interactions that unfold relatively slowly. One day I watched one mother was nursing a pup, and I assumed it was her own pup. And after a couple of hours, that pup just moved on, and another pup moved over, and they settled in. And the first pup that had been nursing on this mother was obviously recognized by another mother who barked at it and brought it back. And so, you know, it can be that the interactions can be very touching. And seeing that beach master gallantly escort that mother down to the water was very touching. So, you know, you don't want to anthropomorphize these critters too much, but they do act in ways that are very interesting to observe.
And what I'm actually just floored by the fact that for every 1 pound a pup gains, the mom loses 2 pounds. Did I hear that?
That is true. That's correct.
That's amazing. So at the end of all this, how much is the mom nursing during that season? Is it constantly that the pups are feeding, or does she get a break?
She doesn't get many breaks. They aren't nursing constantly, but the mothers are available constantly, and the milk is extremely rich. It starts out, I think 20% fat, and by the end of lactation, it's over 50% fat. That's what enables that pup to gain 10 pounds a day during the time it's nursing. So it's actually, at the end of lactation, it's not really liquid at all. It's more the consistency of mayonnaise.
Really?
Yeah, and so it's, you know, think of cow's milk is, 2 to 4% fat? And so this is extremely rich milk, and it's very nutrient-dense. And those critters, there's probably some pictures on the site of how they go from these kind of skinny-looking critters when they're born into absolute butterballs within a month. And they're huge. And then during that time, after the mother leaves them, they've put all that weight on as blubber, but then as they exercise and learn to swim, that blubber is converted into muscle.
If people listening to this want to do something to help, where would you recommend they go, or how could people help elephant seals?
Well, they can certainly support the Friends of the Elephant Seals. They can become a member. They can join through that website. If they live anywhere near this area, we always need more docents. Very interesting. It certainly enriched my life and my knowledge of the natural history of this area.
Christine, tell me, what's your background with animals?
Well, I've always loved animals, and we used to have a horse, and we used to have chickens. And the involvement with chickens actually led to my getting involved with a group called the Society for Preservation of Poultry Antiquities. And I realized that there was a whole area of livestock conservation of traditional breeds that wasn't getting a whole lot of attention. It's starting to get onto the horizon now with the local food movement, but I did realize that there was a need for that information to be put together in book form, and I did have the opportunity to write a book, How to Raise Chickens, part of the FFA livestock series that focuses on raising traditional breeds in small flocks. And with the interest in backyard chickens, that's been gotten quite a bit of attention. So the publisher asked me to write another book about the other kinds of poultry, and I wrote How to Raise Poultry, which includes a chapter on chickens, but it also has chapters on ducks, geese, turkeys, guinea fowl, ostriches, pigeons, game.
and now it's elephant seals. At the rookery, are there better or worse times of the year to visit?
I think there's a calendar on the site that'll tell what's going on. Of course, the most dramatic time is during the breeding season, from late December through March. And that's when there's a lot of activity on the beach. But, you know, I mean, people often ask me that, and I just feel every day I go out there is a great day, you know. There's always activity here, and there's always a good time. And I would suggest if people are going to come to really allow some time.
Thank you so much for talking to me. Really enjoyed our conversation. I'm going to plan my next trip out to visit the seals.
Well, great. I look forward to seeing you, Laurel. Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Christine Heinrichs, author and docent with Friends of the Elephant Seal. You can learn more at elephantseal.org. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed them correctly. As you may have suspected, the animals that make these sounds were the subject of today's interview. Once again, the first sounds you'll hear are a group of female elephant seals, and the second will be bull elephant seals. And now for the males. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.